Energy Espresso stands as a captivating gateway, merging the pulsating world of energy innovations with the deeply ingrained culture of coffee. Every episode serves as a fresh brew of ideas, featuring thought-provoking discussions on the latest in energy technologies, sustainability efforts, and the global transition towards greener alternatives. We invite energy experts, innovators, and thought leaders to share their insights and visions for a sustainable future. Energy Espresso is more than just a podcast. It's a community for those passionate about making a difference and those eager to learn more about the energy that powers our world and the coffee that fuels our days. So, join us on this journey and let's discover together the fascinating intersection of energy solutions and coffee culture, one episode at a time. The Energy Espresso Podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors. Power is complicated, especially during the energy transition. Navigating the process can be confusing, expensive, and difficult to manage. AMP's diversified contract power generation fleet delivers fully managed power with mobile assets ranging from 35 megawatts through 2.5 megawatts, with the objective to provide a utility-like experience. Others call their service leased power or rental power. AMP refers to our service as turnkey contract power. If your organization is in need of temporary or long-term mobile generation for completions, drilling, production, compression, or in-field electrification projects, look no further. Our team is here to deliver excellence. Innovative power delivered so you can focus on business. Contact our team today to learn more. Let's talk power and get amped.
So appreciate everybody joining this week. My name is Dave Bosco and welcome to the Energy Espresso. This week we are joined by John Turner with Atlas Energy, as well as Dave Fate from Stonebriar Commercial Finance. Gentlemen, appreciate you joining the show this week.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks. Glad to be here. Glad to host this event.
Yeah, we're actually at the Stonebriar facilities. And Dave, first off, I mean, beautiful new office you guys got set up here. You just really kind of quickly tell us what inspired you to go with this design in this spot.
I had absolutely nothing to do with the design. The spot we had been working on for several years with the owners of Granite Park and the people that manage the company. They needed an anchor tenant to build this this facility, and we've been in this park since almost 20 years now. So great customer, great relationship with them. Made a cut a deal, a long-term, you know, investment in the company for the top two floors, and, you know, just kind of took it from there. But we had great partners that put this together, and Carrie Stovall and Nick Sandler did a great job of running that project and working with our architecture team, and, you know, here it is, right?
Well, it's beautiful. It turned out great. And being the Energy Espresso, we're going to start off with getting the conversation energized. And John and I have a cup of coffee here that Reagan with Stonebriar was kind enough to go ahead and actually roast these beans himself. These come from a vendor that Reagan uses, where he ends up getting the beans, soaking them in bourbon, and roasting them himself. And this is a little bit more of a bolder floral note, is what I would say. But John, why don't we go ahead and have a drink? And Dave, I think you've got some water you're going to enjoy this week.
I will enjoy my lemon perfect water.
And let's
branding opportunity.
Awesome. Let's get the conversation energized.
Really good.
You chugged yours.
Yes. I like my coffee.
Yeah.
So, while we're on the topic of coffee, and it doesn't have to be coffee, John, maybe if we could start with you, what do you do to get your morning started when it comes to coffee beverage or routine? What does that look like for yourself?
You know, I like to get in the office pretty early. I get in there probably between 6 and 7 in the morning to get the day started. I do drink coffee. I drink one cup of coffee a day. It's a 12-ounce cup of coffee, but it's just black. And, you know, I get in and we have a special blend of coffee there that we have. I don't know the name of the company that makes it, but, and I don't even know the name of the coffee actually, but I know it's the one in the left carafe that I go up and get every morning and I really like. So that's how I get started.
Nice.
Yeah.
Dave, what about yourself? I know you're not a coffee drinker, but what do you do to get energized in the morning?
I'm not a coffee drinker. I get up early. Farm kid from nowhere, Kansas. We were up early doing all the things you have to do. But I drink these little energy kind of dietary shakes. They're kind of a chocolatey flavor, and take all my supplements. And then I'm outside with the dogs for, probably an hour and doing all those fun things. That gets you going.
It definitely does get you going.
It does.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, maybe we can start out with some personal journeys here. John, something that I wanted to kind of start off with is, what gets you out of bed in the morning is as far as John that makes you drives you to do what you do every single day?
I guess what really gets me out of the bed in the morning is, there's many things that get me out of the bed in the morning, like the dogs get me out of the bed in the morning, the kids get me out of the bed in the morning. I tell you, here recently, or over the past 5 or 6 years or 7 years since we started Atlas, I'd say that the main thing that's getting me out of bed now is everything that we're doing at Atlas. It's you want to be at work. It's a great environment that we've created there. We're just bringing the folks from High Crush on board and really adding to the team. But it's really fun to sit in there and work with the team that we've created and the team that we've built, and working with those guys. And, I learn something new every day from these guys, from the team that we've put together. So, that's really kind of what drives me to get me into the office every morning and gets me going.
I love it. And we want to go back to the High Crush topic, here in a little bit. But as a leader, I appreciate you sharing that, you've got a team that, teaches you or learns you something new every single day. I think that's, that's something that is really important, even if you're in a leadership role, right? You hire good people for a reason, because you have them there to go ahead and, still share things that, you may not be able to be in all the details throughout mm-hmm. the day, right?
Right. I mean, we have our philosophy is having a very flat organization from a communication standpoint. Look, no siloing of information. You can't have, if somebody has a great idea, we want to hear it. And so a lot of times when we meet on Monday mornings, or that's when we typically have our meetings, Monday mornings and Monday afternoons, a lot of times those meetings will be filled with a lot of people, not just the executive team. So we want to hear from everybody. And we want to create an environment where a very entrepreneurial environment where everybody's contributing and everybody wants to be there and wants to contribute and feels like feels like their ideas are good ideas. So you never know where the best idea is going to come from. I mean, talking about some of the projects we're working on now, mm-hmm. It didn't necessarily come from, the initial idea didn't necessarily come from the top. It came from, folks that we work with. So
that's fantastic. Dave, getting over to you, what gets you out of bed in the morning and, drives Dave to come and do, work for Stonebriar every single day?
Well, I've been blessed with being able to start and build a number of companies over the years and redo that. I mean, it's just in your blood. It just keeps you, I think about it all the time. Lately, we have a 1-year-old grandson. So anytime we get him at our house, we are just watching that monitor for when he just actually moves. We are flying out of those stairs. We get that kid up and get him away from his mom and go, go have fun with him. So there's a lot of things that do things like that. But I spend a lot of, we cover a lot of things in here that are complicated every day. And kind of like John, it's the ideas and the thoughts come from everyone. You just want to absorb all of it and take it all in. And I have my 24-hour rule where I just, all right, that was a great, I need to think about this. Get out, take the dogs out for 5 miles and just walk and think and get your head around stuff to make, just make accurate, informed decisions. Like John mentioned, we have a very flat organization. We have the whole company literally on a call every Monday morning going through $3.5 billion worth of deals on a weekly basis. Everybody gets a voice. They get to add to the conversation. Whether it's the origination side of the business, the credit side, the asset management side, the legal side, all the different risks you look at, you can just look down the table. How do you guys think about that? And mm-hmm. That's how you make good decisions.
I love it. John, how'd you get your start in the oil and gas business and the sand business specifically?
So I originally started out in the oil and gas business. I was only as an investment banker. This was a long time ago, but I worked 4 years for an investment bank, and then, or actually 3 years for an investment bank, and then Ended up going back on the industry side after business school. And so I originally went to work at Brigham Exploration back in 2001. And that's where I joined up with Bud. I was VP of finance, business development, investor relations, what have you. I mean, there were a number of different titles I wore there. But, you know, the sand business, you know, Bud and I were talking back in, I was about 2015, 16. We're looking to put some money to work in the Permian. We're looking for good opportunities. You know, resources at the time was being sold, or they were going to take it public. And so they needed to, you know, we're looking for an area where, you know, where we can deploy some more capital. We wanted to stay in the Permian Basin. We didn't necessarily need an operated position. I mean, we didn't necessarily want to do an operated position. So we were looking at other places where we could create value for our investors. So, you know, looked at a number of different opportunities and in different parts of the business, and kind of settled on the sand business. Once the in-basin sand rush happened, you know, that's kind of how we got in the business.
And that must have taken a strong gut, to say the least, because at that time, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, sand was really, you know, being sold to mainly the frac service providers. This was prior to EMPs coming in and trying to, you know, separate, let's say, mom from dad, add, you know, be able to recapture some of that margin. How did you see the sand business when you first got into that piece of the market versus where you're at today? Is there any dynamics that you've seen that have shifted in a really big way for your company?
Well, we knew that the supply chain on the supply chain for sand was changing. You were going from a 1,200-mile supply chain to a 60-mile supply chain. You know, we knew as operators. I mean, we brought a different perspective to the business from taking it from an operator standpoint. You know, we knew that once you shorten that supply chain, that operators are going to be more comfortable with sourcing their own sand. And that's one of the things about us as a company is we look at things a little, what I would say is differently. I mean, because, you know, we've pumped, I don't know, I mean, drilled and completed, I don't know how many wells as a company over the past 25, 30 years. And, you know, we've pumped a lot of sand. So when we started this business, that was one of the things that we were really looking at, was taking it from an operator standpoint and building a company and a service around that, you know, that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Now, in those early days of you and Bud starting up the, Atlas Sand, Where does Stonebriar enter into this story and conversation?
So our original capital debt providers, so we raised to capitalize the company originally, we raised some equity capital, basically kind of pass the hat, and then we had another party come in and provide the debt. And then once that debt was coming due, we had done some equipment leasing from Stonebriar. I think that's where we originally started.
Mm-hmm. 2017.
Yeah, so
2018. I think you guys started in 2018 or 17.
So we were started in 17.
Yeah, were you about a year
later? We were looking to do some equipment leasing. We were doing some equipment leasing through a fellow there in Austin. It got too big. He introduced us to Stonebriar, and that's kind of where it all started.
Yeah, sounds about right.
And Dave, what made you look at Atlas and go, these guys have something differentiated? What makes Dave kind of decide, you know, as a company for Stonebriar, where a business can be a good investment or a good partnership?
Well, over time, Reagan Rorschach, you know, one of our, you know, direct originators, doing his job, if you will, came across, I think a small $3 to $5 million, you know, just a follow-on equipment piece. And a year after you guys started, then brought the deal in. And that's kind of a small deal for us. You know, we're doing $500 million deals, but we have a lot of expertise and belief in the Permian Basin, and, you know, been there and just understand it. And a lot was going on in sand. You know, I don't know the numbers, 20 companies and $5 or $10 billion ran in.
Yeah.
Had a strong understanding of shipping the Northern White sand in. We have a rail operating lease business, knew the cost, knew the differentiation of the cost between the two, and just 1,200 miles to 100 miles, that's a good description, but it's mm-hmm. significant cost differential. So we got that understood, just a collateral deal, get a deal going. They think they put a $10 million line in place and did a few pieces of equipment. I really don't even know. I hadn't met these guys yet. They had a, within a year or two, had a situation where we could recapitalize the debt provider you guys had on the balance sheet. And that's when I, you know, that's when I became aware of it. It was a big deal. You know, it took us a while to get to just to understand it. Jeff Wilkerson, our chief risk officer, and I go back to the late 80s, did a lot of the work on it. And I think I actually met you kind of at a closing ceremony on a golf course at first, and then followed by dinner, if I remember that correctly. I don't think I went down there before that, but I could be wrong.
I don't remember.
Too many deals.
Yeah.
Yeah, just too many deals.
I don't remember.
Well, we figured out in a hurry. You know, it was a great relationship. Good, kind of like our company. They just have, they have a highly talented team. Good people, understood what they were doing. You could just tell, you know, you can size people up in a hurry. Just good sure. guys to deal with. I'm a big believer in, and you know, golf guys are good human beings. We got to play a round of golf together. We're both reasonably decent golfers. Had fun doing that. You know, have a few drinks at night, and it just kind of starts from there. And we have a number of relationships like this where we, you know, we call them large, you know, strategic partners, where once we develop those comfort levels, you know, we'll lean in. Mm-hmm. And it's, I'll give all the credit to Jeff Wilkerson on, you know, he's, if you're running a rail car leasing business and all the things they haul there, and he oversees that, he dug into the sand and the stratas and the minerals and the water and the dread. Man, he was all over that.
I've been impressed with Jeff is really dug in.
He is the IP. He has more IP than people on the public side of, you know, looking at your companies.
Yeah.
He really does. And he lives for that stuff, and he'll just find it in the middle of the night when he's, you know, he works all the time and enjoys that. And we really became comfortable, very comfortable, not only the management team. And I got to meet Bud. I think I met Bud for the, he's not a golfer. He's a tennis player, but he went out golfing with us. And, you know, we just got a chance to, you know, spend a lot of time together and became what I'd, you know, just call very good business associates and friends over time. And it's worked out well. And we would, you know, we'd do anything to help these guys. And we can deploy a lot of capital. You know, when they got involved in the Hi-Crust acquisition, they, you know, what do you guys think? Can you help us with this? You know, they, you know, just a normal, and we all flew down there. We had a great meeting with them, and get back a hold of us when you need us. And they did, and it worked out well. And I think we did everything in a fairly expeditious manner to get that done.
Yeah. I mean, we've been very thankful. I mean, these guys at Stonebuyer have been incredible as it comes from a financing partner. I mean, you know, we just work really fast and diligently and mm-hmm. really get the, you know, not really, you know, don't get really strung out on a big negotiation and really focus in on what the points are, you know, the business points. And you know, we've had a great legal team that's been able to, you know, when you talk about, I don't know exactly when, I know I just sent you a text at one point and this Hi-Crust deal, and I said, hey, we're ready to go. Yeah. And this next thing, you know, it's like,
give me a day.
Comes a cavalry running through the door.
Just like, give me a day.
And it was probably less than a month.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
You know, it's fast turnaround.
It is.
Well, and that's, you know, that's a thing that is kind of a strength of ours. And we, you know, we develop a lot of IP across the whole organization, and we're ready to go. It's easy to deploy and execute on. And we were just able to do that. And we're big fans of, you know, thinking strategically. Are we fixing an issue? Are there any issues? Have you thought about this? You're about to become public. Yeah, I know what those guys like to ask sneaky questions. You know, think about, you know, they might hear, if they ask this kind of question, here's these kind of answers, make sure we have, you know, left liquidity to, you know, for a black swan event and things like mm-hmm. that. So we're always thinking about those things as we get involved in any transaction, let alone where we have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of capital. So that's important to us. And we think it's important to, and I think our partners are grateful that we think that way.
Yeah. I mean, I remember we had that discussion on a, either on a hole or watching somebody hit a golf ball. I'm not really sure, but we did have that discussion.
It was number 8 in a bunker. And yeah. I'm like, what? No.
Well, since we're on the Hi-Crust topic, John, if that's something you can talk to a little bit, you know, how did you guys land on that being the right, you know, acquisition for this time? And I guess I'll frame that up with, we're continuing to see a consolidation trend in the oil and gas business, right? You see it at the E&P level, service company level. You know, there's less smaller companies, for lack of a better term, out there. It's getting to be much larger, healthier balance sheets that are being combined. What was the right fit for y'all with Hi-Crust?
You know, Hi-Crust met many of our, you know, when we were looking at any investment that we make, it's got to be meet so many different criteria. And, you know, from our standpoint, we were looking for something that was going to help us meet our long-term goals when it came to basically in the sand business. But we're also looking, we have other goals in the logistics side of the space, you know, return goals, and does it overall support our overall investment thesis, our return thesis that goes to our investors, you know, from the standpoint of returning capital to our investors. And, you know, when you really looked at Hi-Crush, I mean, they kind of checked all the boxes. And then, you know, Hi-Crush has the wet sand business that serves out in the Midland Basin and areas where we didn't necessarily, weren't necessarily providing sand because it's, you know, cost prohibitive to deliver mm-hmm. sand that far. And then you look at the consolidation that's going on, and now you don't just have Delaware Basin players and Midland Basin players anymore. You have companies that are now, you're going to see playing across both of the basins and both sides of the basin. So, you know, it just made a lot of sense once you started looking at it. You combine their Encore with our Dune Express, you combine their Pronghorn with our logistics business. I mean, we had quietly built up one of the largest logistics business in the Permian, and they had done the same thing. You bring those together, and overnight you've got the largest logistics company, sand logistics company in the Permian.
I love it. So it's almost taking a Venn diagram and seeing like, hey, here's the areas we're not playing in, here's the areas they're playing in, and vice versa on the other side. Probably strategic fit from an organizational standpoint. That's really encouraging that y'all looked at it as not a situation where you're cannibalizing business you would otherwise have, right?
Yeah. It's all about getting sand closer to the well site. I mean, that's just something that, you know, as fracs get bigger, you know, simulfracs, trimulfracs, you know, quadfracs. I'm not sure if they're named quadfracs, but
probably will be.
Well, I know they're going on right now. Yeah. And so when you start looking at that, you know, in order to provide sand more efficiently to those operations, you need to be located closer to the well site. So, you know, look at the wet damp sand operation from Encore out in the Midland Basin. And then you look at what the Dune Express is going to do. You know, it's going to move those two sand mines. Now those four sand mines, it's going to move those four sand mines closer out into the heart of the Delaware Basin, which mm-hmm. is arguably, you know, one of the best oil and gas producing regions in the world.
And so
when we were looking at that, and then, you know, you also, like you said, you looked at the culture. I mean, those guys had built look at where Hi-Crush had come from, and look at the company those guys had built. I mean, hats off to those guys. They had built, you know, one hell of a business, and they've got one great culture that's very similar to our culture. And so that's something when we started digging in, that's something, things that we noticed was, man, their culture is very similar to ours. They want to be on the winning team, and so do we. I mean, everybody wants to be on the winning team. You bring those two together, and wow, you've really created something special.
That's awesome.
It's a great story when you hear it. You know, to me, almost on the micro, you see it executed. I go back to like the end of 21 or 22, and I think Conoco acquired, who was it? Shell. They got one of a business of Shell's, and we just thought, oh, that was a big deal, $10 billion deal. What did they all get? Land, pipes, this and that, you know. Well, then you get to the end of 23, and they just take off. Exxon Pioneer, Occidental Crown Cork, yep. Diamondback Endeavor.
Yep.
Well, we had our lot. We see stuff like that, and it's always the waterfall effect.
Yep.
Okay, well, the E&P guy, they're rolling up. They've been on the sidelines. They've made more money. They've made a ton of money. They've bought shares back. They've done everything they can do. They are ready to go to work. They're just buying. They're buying capacity. They're buying acreage. Well, who's going to need that? And we're sitting here thinking of these guys, and then you get a phone call, right? But you're gonna see waterfall effects out of it.
Sure.
This is a lot.
Yep.
This is $150 billion of deals. Let's see where we are in 5 years talking about the waterfall effect of this. Mm-hmm. This is a big thing.
It's very exciting. I think with all of the transformational things that are happening in the oil and gas business, I look at when I first started in this industry, you know, just about 19 years ago, and, you know, my father-in-law got me interested in it. And he's like, you know, son, you know, we've been doing this essentially the same way, you know, for 50 or 60 years. But you look at where technology-wise we're at today, the maturity of businesses, right? It's not the, you know, drunken sailors mentality that it used to be by any means. You know, you've got capital efficiency that's being focused on, you know, returning share buybacks, you know, back to investors, smart decisions that are being made on the investment side, new technologies are being adopted for this manufacturing type of approach, which is something I want to get into with the Dune Express that I think is pretty interesting. What would you say, Dave, I guess to start with you, like, are those some of the reasons why you're going, you know what, oil and gas is actually a fantastic investment opportunity for other folks that honestly I feel like are sitting on the sidelines in the capital markets today?
Yeah, I mean, I'll take it from 100,000 foot. You know, we run a large, diversified commercial finance company. We get to see so many different industries and asset classes way outside, you know, outside of just energy, anything energy related. But we have deep person, you're in Texas, been doing this for 40 years in Texas at four different companies. We just know what works out there. Doesn't mean we have a lot of exposure. We pick our winners and pick the companies to get involved with. Never really got involved in the E&P side. That just wasn't our cup of tea. But the midstream businesses and the service providers and things like that, we've always been in and out of that side. But it cycles, right? So one of the best things about our business is I talked about everyone in the company sitting together Monday morning going through billions of dollars of deals, you can see where risk and return get out of balance. It doesn't matter if it's structure, it's pricing, it's industry issues. You can just start seeing when, okay, let's watch that. Let's see what's going on. And you're not forced to deploy capital in just one area.
Sure.
So that's that. From that macro viewpoint is when you kind of think about things. This industry over the last 5 or 6 years, I mean, I always think about timing. We couldn't have started our business any better time in 2015 when coming out of the financial crisis and GE Capital's last big independent and became a bank holding company, became a designated SIFI. They were trying to sell off assets. We knew they were going to close the business down. And literally the week we launched this business 9 years ago last month, they sold everything, but created a massive void in the marketplace. You just see that happening all the time. You saw all that. You saw all the, you know, saw all the PE dollars, billions. 20 companies spring up. Our marketing guys looked at every one of them. We said no to everything. Just undercapitalized, wrong operators, wrong guys. We just, you know, no, no, no. Kind of like electric vehicles.
Sure.
Turn Tesla down 3 times.
Wow.
Just no, no, no. It's not sustainable. Well, look where most of them are now. That would have been a bad equity investment. Wouldn't have been a very good loan or use of our money, right?
Makes sense.
So I look at everything from that perspective. I've got a lot of different things to deploy capital in. You know, onshoring of anything manufacturing right now is on fire.
Yep.
That's not going to stop. Mm-hmm. That's, you know,
buy USA made, you know, products
that's
is key.
Not gonna stop. That's a big thing. So I get back to the all things on the energy side of the business. The data points I read off earlier about just the huge amount of money on the M&A side, that's going to waterfall through for a while. And it's going to have winners and losers. You know, the industry you're in is very interesting to us.
Sure.
We've spent a significant amount of probably 3 years of IP on that industry. And obviously are very, we've put our money where our mouth is, if you will, and deployed a lot of capital there. And we think that's in the infancy stage.
Totally. No, electrification is going to be one of the big movers, I think, going forward. I mean, today it's grown significantly, and I think it's got a ton more runway, not only in the oil and gas space, but power in general is a challenge we all have issues with.
Data centers, grids. I mean, look, everyone's worried about grids everywhere and power everywhere, right?
Absolutely. It's keeping a lot of people up at night.
It is. It absolutely is.
So, you know, it's interesting we're talking about power, Dune Express, John. Something that I was interested in, you know, what made you and Bud wake up one day and go, we're going to build a conveyor belt system that's going to move sand from one side of the Permian to the other?
Well, you know, it actually started pretty much from the day that we founded. I mean, the day that when we locked up and closed our deal on our first dune up there, the Kermit Dune. You know, we had spent some time out there. We've been spending a lot of time out there actually, knowing that it wasn't the most efficient way to deliver sand via truck on public road.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we started looking at a number of different technologies at that point. And, you know, some of these ideas were way out there, delivering via helicopter. I mean, you know, but we ran them all down. And, you know, that's really where we started working on it pretty much at the same time that the company was founded. So, you know, we knew that moving oil and water off location, you know, used to be done by truck. Today it's done by pipeline. You know, what were the technologies that we could do that we could deploy that would reduce the amount of truck traffic and make it safer, make life. I mean, we have people that live in those communities. We've lived in those communities. You know, we care about the people. You know, you're five times as likely to die in a traffic accident if you live in a, what we call a sand producing county or an oil producing county, than you are in the rest of the state of Texas. So, you know, we were actually, this was, you know, back in 2018, 2019, we're really looking for the right technology to move sand. And we looked at a bunch of different technologies, rail, we looked at everything and, you know, decided upon the conveyor. I mean, we looked at, there's actually a 12-mile conveyor outside the city of Austin. It's owned by the city of Austin that somebody came, one of the conveyor, guess manufacturers came to us and said, hey, look, there is a 12-mile conveyor outside the city of Austin. It connects a lignite mine to a lignite power plant. The city of Austin was getting out of the lignite business. So they had they were in the process of decommissioning the plant where they were shutting it down. So we actually went out, drove out there, met with the entire team that ran this conveyor. And at that point in time, it was like, wow, this is actually the way that we need to move sand. It's, you know, moving large amounts of aggregate long distances, the preferred way to do that around the world is via conveyor. And most of those environments are much more harsh than what we're dealing with there in West Texas. I mean, you're coming from, you look at, you know, these deposits way up in these mountains and bringing them all the way down to a coast or to a mine and, you know, coming, you know, very difference in terrain. I mean, out in the Permian Basin, I mean, I think total elevation change is 300 feet from the mine gate where it goes onto the belt and then where it exits at the end of the 42 miles. So, but yeah, I mean, it was very early in the formation of the company that we started looking at this.
That's super cool. And that's, you know, I've been exposed to conveyor belt systems in traditional mining applications where you're talking about coming out of an open pit, you know, and that grade could be, you know, call it 13, 14% grade. Like it's quite the hike up there. Outside of the road traffic, which I commend you for, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, not only protecting people that work for our companies, but the communities that we operate in is super critical. What are some of the other benefits that you've seen from an operation standpoint, efficiency, emissions, you know, reducing kind of the time that it takes to dry out sand? Are there any other value drivers that you saw with a conveyor system?
I mean, I think, you know, first off is, you know, conveyor, you know, you pointed something out that I failed to mention was in our plants, we actually have 5 miles of conveyor. So, you know, one of the things that makes our plants so efficient is our use of conveyors, where we got away from some of the traditional uses of bucket elevators and things like that have a high rate of failure. You know, we were using conveyors because we knew that conveyors were more reliable. As far as moving sand down a conveyor, I mean, it's going to be a lot more efficient. It runs 24 hours a day. You know, your main cost is going to be electricity, but you are significantly reducing emissions. I don't have the exact numbers, but we have these numbers in a number of presentations that are on our website. But, you know, we significantly reduced the amount of diesel we've significantly reduced the amount of miles driven. And, you know, there's just a number of other things. I mean, the actual number of trucks you're going to use to deliver sand to supply a well site that's out by off the end of our conveyor is going to be significantly reduced because those trucks can make a lot shorter turns. So you're reducing the total. May not be reducing the loads, but you're actually reducing the number of folks that are coming onto an operator's well site, which we know from our history as operators is you want to reduce the headcounts of people on your well site, not increase them. And then when you combine that with the multi-trailer operations is when in operating what we call these heat zones, high efficiency autonomous zones out there. You know, it's going to really create a bunch of efficiencies out there that we don't even know. Today we have an idea about, you know, some of the things that the benefits of the conveyor is going to be, but I guarantee you the benefits of taking sand off the conveyor are going to be significant. And then you build that main artery and then you get the vascular network going out from there. And, you know, it's just going to be more efficient.
That's brilliant. And I would presume because of that, John, you know, you're also looking at a certain, you know, type of customer that fits really well inside of your, you know, let's say customer matrix that your team may have going out there and looking for specific operators that are trying to get more per linear foot, right? Because I would assume there's like a throughput that you're able to deliver versus somebody who's solely relying on trucks to be able to get that material on location much more quickly and efficiently, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, and that's really, I mean, you've got these big blocky positions up in the Delaware Basin. I mean, it's no surprise that that's where the first conveyor ended up, where it first went. I mean, there's a lot of these large, just blocky acres positions where, you know, it's what this is becoming is a manufacturing operation. It's a mm-hmm. factory on the ground out there, and having one of the most important parts of that parts of the completion, the sand being delivered efficiently to a location is highly important to make sure that those companies can have the sand they need to pump, that they need to pump, and make sure that that's there when they need it, and so they're not having to shut the frac jobs down.
I love it. Shifting gears a little bit, something that I wanted to start off with Dave is, you know, Dave, with, you know, multiple different opportunities existing inside of the oil and gas and industrialization space. You had touched on power is an area you see continuing to be a big driver. What are some of the other things that you're seeing out there in the oil and gas or industrialization space that you and the Stonebriar team have your pulse on?
Well, just in the energy space, everything on the service side, you know, whether it's from, and they're all changing, you know, fuel, right? They've gone to dual fuel, they're going to LNG, they're going to portable power. That's still a very big opportunity. Plus all these boys just consolidated, they're going to drill a lot of wells.
Yeah.
So you just got to imagine that's going to be a significant opportunity for years to come.
Yep.
We have a lot of other areas that we think about outside of the energy space, just like in the Jones Act maritime space. You know, you've met a couple of our guys there in a company mm-hmm. we've helped launch, and Maritime Partners and Dick and Austin. That industry, from my perspective, is ripe for some consolidation. You've got timed out operators, you've got assets that need replaced, and the capital to do that is finite. Areas we have deep expertise in. Everything on the industrial manufacturing onshoring side is very early days. There are plants and facilities in outside of Houston that make chemicals and things that no one wants in their backyard, and no one can rebuild them. And those facilities will be there forever. They just need hundreds of millions of dollars of maintenance capex all the time, and they're typically owned by large, you know, corporate entities and obviously very big companies, but you can't run the world without them. There's generally one or two of those only that control most of the output that's going on in North America, let alone other areas. So those kind of irreplaceable high barrier to entry assets are always something we look at. We just recently financed two ocean-going ships, very efficient, after that service 50% of all the goods going to Hawaii, because we were talking about they own the only port over there.
Wow.
There's no other acreage. These ships actually replace ships I financed at Transamerica 25 years ago. But the efficiency in two new ships like that are significant, right? So, you know, there's always, those are the type of things we look for. A lot of capital, very unique assets, irreplaceable, and serve a need that, is servicing goods and, you know, bringing all the goods and services into Hawaii is never going to be replaced by anyone else. So.
Sure.
Those kind of things are macro things we look at all the time. Now, there's always areas that pop up. There's areas that popped up around data centers. There's areas popped up. You hear all things NVIDIA, and they talk about coming out with some new supercomputer cluster of this. Or who's financing the current ones? You know, we love that stuff. It takes three to five years for an operator just to be trained to operate one. First of all, you announce you're going to build it. That's a four-year build cycle. Then mm-hmm. you got to get the people to operate them. You're propping up data centers everywhere. AI is going to drive tremendous demand for electricity,
yep,
people, and power.
Absolutely.
Those are things we're always going to think about macroly, and just where the best places are to deploy capital. And there's a lot of opportunities.
No, I love it, man.
Not electric vehicles.
Yeah. No, I mean, and, you know, with going down that rabbit hole, I think one of the biggest farces that, you
well,
know,
we could be wrong.
The public,
we're wrong all the time. But.
No, I mean, I think if electric vehicles were going to be the answer, there would have been a huge mass shift in adoption of that technology. But it seems like the amount of people that want EVs have got them. And you see a lot of these organizations capitulating, for lack of a better term, on what their strategy was a year and a half ago to go and like, you know what? We think fossil fuels and maybe some enabling of alternative fuels, which is still a commodity you can fill up your tank and have the relative experience that you would with gas, right? With diesel fuel or gasoline.
Well, other forms of power, hydrogen. I think I mentioned that earlier. You know, our maritime partners team is developing the first hydrogen-powered push boat. Very fascinating. You know, we're financing it. It's under construction. It's probably halfway through that. I'm not sure of the dates, but can't wait to see how that's accepted and deployed into the marketplace. That's a game changer.
Yeah, totally. I'm a big fan of hydrogen. I think there's a lot of room to grow on the distribution of that commodity, to say the least. But the installations that, you know, you and I have talked about, and also, what, you know, I've seen, let's say, some micro installations inside the United States where you're putting the production of that H2 very close to where the consumption source is going to be, makes a lot of sense today. I think in the future, we need to see a lot more adoption of building out the, you know, transport, whether it's over the road or using existing pipelines. But what's beautiful is like hydrogen can be used in most of the equipment that we all have today. You know, you look at, you know, the Maritime Partners deal, they can take an existing diesel engine, I would presume, Dave, and probably inject some hydrogen in there, get benefits on emissions and fuel consumption. Same thing with, you know, the power generation assets.
I think you should
that are
them on
there.
Your podcast and ask them.
Yeah, I would love to. I'd love to.
There you go, Austin. You're up next.
No, that's fantastic. John, going back to you, my friend, what would you say advice-wise you would give to a young person wanting to get into this industry and start up a business? What have you seen through your journey as some tidbits of knowledge you would want to share with somebody?
You know, it's funny, Mike. About a month ago, I was sitting there with some of my youngest daughters in fifth grade, and she said, "Dad, the teacher today was talking about peak oil." And I was like, you know, she knew that probably would like strike a chord. But she's like, "You need to tell my friends here that, you know, peak oil is, tell them what you know about peak oil." And I was like, you know, that's the same thing that they used to tell us whenever I was in grade school, is about your same age. So I think its future is very bright in the industry. And I would not hesitate to tell anybody, any kid that's looking to go into the business, to not go into the business. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of technology going on. There's a lot of innovation that's going on. But there's a lot of areas where value can be created. And, you know, I feel very strongly about that. If my kids want to get in the oil and gas business, I'd tell them I'd be fully supportive of it.
Mm-hmm.
The future's bright.
No, it definitely is. I think where a number of people forecasted, not only from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s, right? It's kind of that same theme. Mm-hmm. There seems to be more of an agenda that's being pushed than actual facts and reality that are being used. And, you know, all the forecasts about 2030, right? By 2030, we're going to be totally off of oil.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we've seen here lately that natural gas is going to still like persist. It's the only firm fuel that we have for power generation. Mm-hmm. And it's a feedstock for everything. You know, something I get into conversations with, you know, folks that we may not align exactly when it comes to the political spectrum, is like, do me a favor, look around your house. And I want you to pick out everything that you think does or does not come from oil and gas products, right? There is, from the clothes we wear to the materials we have, like oil and gas is in everything.
Shampoo and makeup.
Yeah, totally. It's not, and it's not this, you know, demon product that I think most people have painted it to be. You look at how sustainably actually we produce oil and gas in this country. It should be something we talk more about in the United States. Is, you want a model for how to produce oil and gas? copy and paste the United States. Like, we do a damn good job at it.
Those boys that just did all the consolidation, they've got it down.
Yep.
They are thoughtful about it. They put a lot of time and energy into it, and they know it's the right thing to do.
Totally.
Yep, they do.
And you've seen, you know, Sarah Week was, you know, a week and a half ago, and just the shift in the paradigm where everybody's saying, look, we're cutting back on our ESG investments. And that's not necessarily saying that, you know, they're not trying to still be sustainable. It's just like, look, they're sticking to what they know best and is needed for the long-term future, which is a firm fuel everybody can rely on, right? And it also returns investment, like investment grade fundamentals in business too, right? I personally feel oil and gas is still severely undervalued in today's market. Like, it's a great investment opportunity.
I mean, cheap source of, I mean, it's cheap energy. And that's what we need to continue to do, is to create and produce cheap energy so other parts of the world can flourish. I mean, we've built our country on a cheap energy source, and you know, we need to continue to do that to the underdeveloped areas around the world. I mean, Alex Epstein talks about that. You know, we all know who Alex is. So
it's dependable.
Yeah,
it is
highly but dependable.
I like the question you asked John about, and he talked about his own kids, about the young kids in the industry. You know, we get asked that question a lot.
Well, that question's coming right at you, Dave. Why don't we go there? Tell me, what would you tell somebody, not only in, I would almost like in two parallels from you. One, oil and gas centric, what would you tell somebody that's interested in getting into the oil and gas business? And then what would you tell a young person that wants to get into the financial business that may be under the oil and gas or energy belt?
I'd tell that young person to get in the commercial finance business and then learn about the oil and gas business.
Okay.
But, well, I've had the, you know, a little backstory. Jeff Wilkinson, who I mentioned earlier, and I, you know, he and I go back to the late 80s. Four different commercial finance companies, all here in Plano, Texas, of all places, you know, when there was only 20,000 people here. You know, we woke up one day after we had sold the Transamerica business, and we were launching the business at AIG, and I had some senior guys, Kirk Phillips and Dan Fluharty and Joe Thompson. We all walk in, we're in our early mid-40s, and I'm like, guys, we are old. You know, you look in the mirror, and we need some young guys in here. We need to start bringing in young talent for the first time ever, as we thought about as we launched these businesses. And so we made a couple of decisions, you know, just... We didn't really want to recruit kids right out of college. We'd like to find some maybe a few years out of school that had a little, you know, life experience, if you will. And we had a revelation, I guess, about hiring kids that were athletes. Now, they had to be qualified. They didn't know how to what to do. But, you know, those kids got up. They were disciplined. They worked out. They managed their grades. They knew how to win. They knew how to fail. They got yelled at by a coach. They got over it 2 seconds later and, you know, moved on down the road. So that was a very successful first foray for us in there in like 2004 through the 2007 timeframe before AIG ran through its issues in the financial crisis. But we proved it worked, and we did a good job of cross-training them all throughout the organization. You know, we really didn't care where they went to school and what their major was per se. I mean, you needed a business major and a finance background would have been ideal. But you know, you hire those kids, you get in there, you know, they had great soft skills. You train them, you run them through the organization, and then sooner or later you had a need, and a permanent opportunity became irrelevant or prevalent for them. More importantly, they raised their hand and go, oh my God, I love accounting. Well, we got rid of those guys, but no. they love marketing. They love capital markets. They love credit. They love the asset management side of the business. They were gearheads. They ended up being unbelievably good employees, and it worked extremely well. You know, we've kind of taken that to the next level here, and we were just thoughtful about how we build these companies. I only got 46 people here on a $6.5 billion balance sheet. It's very efficient, you know, doing a few billion dollars a year of new business. But we have, I think, 9 guys in their 20s and 11 in their 30s and probably the same amount in their 40s. And then, you know, a few of us in the executive platinum division, as I like to call it.
Okay.
But it works extremely well to have redundant backup capabilities all throughout the organization. It builds it for sustainability. And for the young person coming in, and we're hiring kids now out of college, you know, we can bring them through internship programs. You find the people that really have the, you know, by the end of 3 or 4 months, really, really hits and it takes to them. You know, every one of those kids, and the best selling point is everything we do here is a mini new job. here, you're working on a business aviation deal one day, a rail car leasing deal one day, a maritime push boat deal, deal with, a battery company one day, a chemical company, an energy company, electrification energy company, a sand company. I mean, look at all the different things
you can
lump into that industry, but you get to learn everything about it. It's a mini case study, if you will. It's a mini homework. You just get to tear through that from cradle to grave. Well, they love that. Everybody, it's the best part about the job. It's all the deals and the customers. And we get them out in the field. We want the marketing guys taking them out in the field, the asset guys taking them out, anyone you can get them out in the field. We take them to the industry conferences. We ship them around to meet as many people. And you've met some of our guys. Both of you guys know our people, and bring them all in here at our investor conference. Those are invaluable. They're an integral part of the team, and they can just take, and the ones that want to take it and take it as far as they can and be really successful, they will. You can just tell if they have a passion for it. So I think it's the best job in the world. And, we've got a lot of the young guys that do the on-campus recruiting and do a good job of bringing them in here. So you can tell I'm pretty passionate about that. I think it's been a great, it's a great industry. It's been a great career. And you get to meet guys like yourself and do business with them and advocate for the industries. And we think that's important. We like to show up at all those events.
Yep. I love it, man. And I really appreciate you bringing up the failure piece of it, because, a lot of younger generations, I would say, and this is not to paint with a broad stroke by any means, think that, failure is something that you can't have happen in life. But it's a fact of life. It's just, how do you learn from that and apply that failure to make sure you never have it happen again, or you have something that you could learn from that? They can apply to a different situation, right? It's part of freaking life. You don't win 1,000% of the time.
Yeah. We say it kind of in our business. You remember the deals that went bad way more than the billions that went that were great, right?
Sure.
You do, and you learn. At the end of the day, you just learn from them and you move on. And hopefully, there's always takeaways from those things. So that's that's kind of how we think about that, especially with building the redundant skill level throughout this organization.
I love it.
And they do have to be golfers.
Yeah, man. Hey, being a golfer, that is definitely not a bad pre-qualification.
I tell you, I like to interview people on a golf course, especially marketing guys. And I've had them show up. I'll pick you up at DFW. We're going there. Oh, I'm not a golfer. I don't care. We're golfing today. Because I can learn as much of how a guy handles himself. Is he a good golfer? He's not a good golfer. How he reacts to it. How the guy that's not a golfer just gives it the old college try.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't matter. But you give me 5 hours in a golf cart and I'm pretty well, we're going to know something. How's your kids? How's your family? You're a Michigan Wolverine. I always have it with John. My son's an OU guy. He's all the big Texas guys. So I'm like, John, I should throw out a boomer right now. And he's like, no, go stand over there. Don't do that around me. That's the kind of stuff you learn.
I like it. Couple more questions. So something I wanted to, I'll first ask you, John, what is one opportunity to give a shameless plug? So it could be a charity, something you feel passionately about. Is there anything that you do in your spare time or support that you wanted to mention on the Energy Espresso podcast?
I was not expecting that one. Let me think about it.
Yeah, while he's thinking about it.
That's okay. So we can shift to Dave.
So it's a great question. And over the years and being able to go through, three big public companies, and ITT, Transamerica, and AIG, they would have things, and things they supported as organizations. And it got us thinking about it as well. And especially here at Stonebriar, where, we're large, privately owned, independent, a few years ago, probably more than I think, we formed our own kind of corporate responsibility committee. I've been a part of the Byron Nelson and the Momentous Institute and the First Tee for almost 29 years. I've got to see people come through that First Tee organization, which basically takes kids that are just coming out of a horrible situation, and a family, if you will, becomes big brothers, adopts them, whatever they need to do to change their life. We've seen that migrate through to the point where they've gone through, they learn how to just function on a golf course with the basic rules of being a golfer, to graduating high school, to graduating college, to having their own kids. And the guy ends up caddying for me a year ago and goes, "Mr. Fate, I remember you at a first tee organization, you know, 7 years ago. I just want, you know, I'm telling you, I've got three kids. I got my own boys in this. I live over here. Saw your name and I wanted to caddy for you in this deal."
Man,
that means as much to me as anything can. And our whole organization now is significantly wrapped up in that first tee organization. It's a national organization. One of my young guys I talked about, you know, he's early 30s now, and he's on their board. Wow. And he drives a lot of those initiatives and agenda for us. So that, you know, that's one that's just always been very special to us because it impacted something, you know, we can see local and realistic answer. So a year ago, I got a phone call from a what I'm going to say is a longtime friend. You know, knew my daughter when she was, 10 or 11 years old, started playing volleyball before she went off, you know, did that at college and did all that. But she's the local regional director of this organization called Johnny and Friends.
Okay.
Well, it basically gives what I would say, all these people are basically in wheelchairs. They first started out accessing enough wheelchairs globally for people that needed them.
Wow.
Well, then it kind of migrated into, you know, I would call it as simple as trying to help a family with a disabled person, give them a life experience they normally couldn't have happen. So the week before the OU Texas game this year, notice I said OU first, our company, I think, had a dozen people go down to the state fair and meet that organization. And there were a number of kids that were, you know, disabled, if you will, and had, you know, situation. Well, they would take them on rides. They would, and as much as anything, you'd free their family up and the other siblings so that their family could do the same thing on their own. You know, my son, Grant, and my daughter were part of that. They knew Becky Ellis, who ran that organization. And Grant got he got paired with a young man that was, you know, severely disabled and was big and strong enough to be able to take him on rides and do things and free they came back, that touched them.
Yeah.
NBC News filmed the whole thing, released it on New Year's Eve, or I think, and as just a unbelievable story. I'm sure it's on our LinkedIn pages and our websites and stuff like that. But when you can, you know, it's one thing to go pack boxes of food at a warehouse. It's another to go hold a human being.
Yes.
And can feel him react. And my son said it better in his own words. But those kind of organizations, that's meaningful. And I think it's very meaningful, the people in our organization that got to participate in that. So those are two. We have others, but those are two good ones that really resonate with us.
No, and that's beautiful, from impacting a young person's life on the one side of it that was at a disadvantage socioeconomically, you know, life unfortunately happened to them and they would have been, you know, in a much different spot if you guys wouldn't have supported and, you know, been a part of an organization that could help lift them up out of that situation, right? That's very beautiful. And then also the, you know, the disabled piece of it. My wife's aunt is one of those individuals that has, you know, benefited from a charity such as what you're talking about, that she is bound to a wheelchair, essentially. She can't, you know, do anything without it. And that sense of freedom and independence that they get to have that they otherwise wouldn't be able to, it makes them feel, I would assume, a little bit more like they're a part of everything else that's going on, right?
It gives them a very good experience.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. Very touching. John? Anything
you know, I don't necessarily know that we have any specific cause, but you know, we're real involved in the communities out there in West Texas, and we, you know, obviously want the best for those communities, and you know, we participate all the way down to the from the little kids all the way up to the high school level. You know, we partner a lot with the school districts out there. We've got training programs for a lot of the schools. We actually have, we're putting in a simulator that we're using to train our folks to run heavy equipment. And we're letting the schools come in, and they're actually going to start training some of their students on our heavy equipment simulators. But you know, we just to support the communities out there, and whether it be local law enforcement, whether it be the Rotary Club, whether it be specific charities for whatever it worked for you know, underprivileged. You know, we're just real involved in that out there in West Texas. So
that's awesome. The investment that you guys are making in outfitting, you know, let's say those high school kids that maybe don't want to go to college, mm-hmm. but they want to get out into the workforce immediately, maybe after a little bit of trade school. That's something that I feel we have been missing from, you know, our society that used to be a big part of it. When I was in, you know, high school myself, you had machine shop, you know, you could go and become a network architect. That's what I did, you know, out of high school was going to a trade school to be a network engineer. Mm-hmm. I really think that's really cool. Have you guys been able to attract talent and bring them over yet from those training programs and that early exposure to operating equipment into your business?
And we've had some kids that have come along and made the transition over from high school into working in our plants out there. Not necessarily heavy equipment operating because that's something that's new, but yeah. Other ways that we've been able to give them exposure and give them internships out there in, you know, in our plants and our operations out there.
That's awesome. So that's awesome.
Well, you know, the need for the trade schools and the colleges have got themselves poked in the eye over the last year without getting into that whole thing. I mean, there are other ways to be very successful.
Yep.
And, you know, the more emphasis on that is needed.
Yep.
It's just needed as we continue to grow as a country.
Yep. No, I love it. I really appreciate you gentlemen taking the time to come on the podcast and think it was a great conversation. And love to have some more follow-ups in the future. Anything you want to say to anybody before we close out?
I could keep going.
Keep going? Well, listen,
this is the kind of stuff that I can just continue to talk with all day. It's what we do. You know, it's what we do in our industries. You get together, you know, a month ago I was together with like 60 CEOs in our Equipment Finance and Lease Association. And, you know, you go down an agenda, you hear a economist talk who doesn't even talk about $34 trillion of debt. I had to call him out on that. I go, how do you do that? You talk, you know, isn't that your job?
You know, it's a rounding error.
But anyway, you get best practice. You get to talk about that. You know, it's not like there isn't a significant number of real world events going on that could arguably be as bad as we've ever seen it.
Yep.
You know, you get a chance to get together with your peers and how are you handling this? How are you discussing this? What are we doing about, you know, I don't need to hear there's enough serious things going on. We got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, a lot of people don't like to talk about them, but they're just part of the world we are in today.
Well, gentlemen, thank you again and appreciate everybody tuning in to this week's Energy Espresso and keep on keeping the energy industry energized and look forward to speaking with you next time.
Thank you.
Thank you.